Okay, this is the hour we're going to take your phone calls with Mark Zakri as we talk about the Twilight Zone and Hollywood, Space Command, and you name it. We'll take care of it on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Mark Zakri, of course, your phone calls just ahead. Mark, with all the things that you have written in your life and in your career, what area do you like? Do you like the books, the e-books, the scripts? What do you like?
Well, you know, it's fun. I enjoy writing novels. I enjoy writing nonfiction books. But for me, television has always been my first love, our drama, science fiction shows. And really, that's what Space Command is, too. So for me, the real culmination of everything is what I'm doing right now, to create and run my own science fiction show. Ever since I was a kid, I was given a Christmas present of a trip to the Star Trek set. I was there for the shooting of the last of the original Star Trek episodes, Turnabout Intruder. And I think right there and then I said, this is what I want to do with my life. And to stand on my own spaceship sets now to project a whole future universe, that's a dream come true.
You have built your own sets.
Yes.
That has got to be glorious. For you.
It is. It truly is. And, you know, it's just so great. And then when I bring, you know, hundreds of people in as my crew, my team, my actors, all of that, and we're all sharing that and working together, it doesn't get better, you know, and it's lovely to greenlight myself. I don't need a studio or a network to make this happen. All I need is my audience. And because I've always seen myself as the same as my audience, if I like what I'm doing, I know the audience will, because we're the same. I don't look down on my audience at all. We're thrilled by the same things, and it's just great. It's terrific.
Is Hollywood, big budget Hollywood, taking notice with what you're doing?
Yes, they are. You know, it's for me, the people who really matter in terms of when you say Hollywood are my brother, writer, director, producers. So to have Guillermo del Toro or Damon Lindelof, I just got an email from Damon Lindelof the other day where he signed it, "Your fan." And this is the guy who created Lost. You know, it's like he's running The Leftovers. I had no idea that he thought of himself that way. And that's incredibly gratifying. But ultimately, it's the work. That really, I mean, we recognize each other through the quality of our work. That's why you and I are friends.
Yeah.
And you know, it's you know, as I said earlier, I talked about kindred spirits, and so we're all part of this community of creating something meaningful and something worthwhile.
Ebook, The Twilight Zone Companion, the
yes.
new edition is an ebook. Tell me why you came out in an ebook form.
Well, you know, it's because of the possibility of doing audio and video and all of that. The being able to be able to click on something and immediately watch it or hear it. Now, there will be a physical paperback edition. There will be a hardcover edition in the days to come, but I wanted to try this new form. I always like being on the cutting edge. I like trying new things. I don't stay with the tried and true. I always like pushing the envelope, and particularly because I produced the Twilight Zone Blu-ray and the DVD set and did 52 audio commentaries on the recent Blu-ray. And so it just seemed like a natural extension. And when I realized that I could share so many of the things with the reader that I couldn't before, the fact that I can write about patterns, which was Rod's first big success in the 1950s, and you can actually click through and watch it, or I can write about The Time Element, which was the first Twilight Zone pilot that was actually aired as a Desilu Playhouse, and you can click through and see it. That's just phenomenal to me and quite wonderful.
Okay, let's go to the calls. We're starting to line up here for you, Mark. Let's go to Victor, driving through Sacramento, west of the Rockies. Victor, you're on with Mark Zakri. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, Mark.
Hello, Victor.
You know, it's kind of nice to hear your voice. I don't know you, but I feel like I do. And it also feels like I could just call you on the cell phone and talk to you, and you know,
sure.
It's just amazing. It's nice to have that refreshing side of Hollywood.
Thank you.
My question is, with the big giant mega movies that are in and they're making millions and millions of dollars, who's the controller of that money and how do they allocate it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Basically, at the end of the day, it's these big corporations. It used to be illegal for a company to own a studio and a network together. In fact, Viacom used to be the syndication arm of CBS, and the courts forced them to sell it off.
To split up, yeah.
And then they swept all those laws away during the Reagan administration, and now you got what was called vertical integration, where a studio and a network could be owned by the same parent company, and that's how you now have these huge...
NBC has Universal, right?
NBC, Universal, ABC, Disney, etc. And as a result of that, those are the guys who hold the purse strings. They've got billions of dollars. So, for instance, Disney bought Star Wars. They paid George Lucas $4 billion to buy Star Wars, And now, of course, they're planning, you know, George Lucas went decades without making another Star Wars film, and now, of course, they're going to make a Star Wars film every
They're
going to
get
year.
All their investment back in
right.
one movie, huh?
Right. Well, they're planning to make Star Wars films every single year, and they have a number
wow.
of them in various stages of production now. So they're going to be doing a young Han Solo movie. They're doing a Star Wars film called Rogue One. You know, so they've got plans, and hopefully it'll be, you know, so far so good. I think J.J. Abrams is going to do a very good job. I think it's going to be a very, very good film.
How could George Lucas, because he was part of this in a very big way, but it's not his.
No.
How could he get motivated knowing that he's sitting on $4 billion and this isn't his movie?
Well, you know, I think for George Lucas, it had gotten to a point where he was, you know, overseeing this huge empire, and he wanted to do something different. He wanted to sort of have that weight taken off his shoulders. And I think it really was a good thing to pass on the mantle.
Because, oh, sure.
You know, many of the fans were not pleased with the last three Star Wars films. I think they were very entertaining for children and delivered what they delivered. But I think J.J. will bring a new, perhaps, maturity or a new weight to it, I hope. And, you know, he and I have talked about, you know, it's funny because when he did the Star Trek films, he's not a Star Trek fan, but he felt a responsibility to do them well. But he's a huge Star Wars fan, and he really feels the responsibility of this. So, and he's a very talented fellow. So we'll see what happens.
Did not Star Wars put Harrison Ford on the map?
Yeah, it did, and he's you know, and it, I'm really glad they brought back Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher. I think
a
very
you
good
have
move.
To.
Yeah, but in terms of the question of who owns the purse strings, who runs Hollywood, it's definitely the studios and the networks and their corporate masters. And again, they're going to determine what gets made and what doesn't. But the lovely thing is now, thanks to the Internet, thanks to crowdfunding, there's an alternate way to go. And it's not just for me. It's for literally thousands of artists, writers, directors, producers, musicians. Amanda Palmer raised $1.2 million on Kickstarter. She's Neil Gaiman's wife and a singer, very talented. And she wrote a book called The Art of Asking, which is about the new relationship between the audience and the performer, the creator, and it's much more direct and much more collaborative, and I'm hugely in favor of that.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Welcome to the program, Joe. You're on with Mark
hey.
Zucre.
Hey,
Joe.
George. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to ask Mark, now, there was a series called Night Gallery.
Yes.
Rod Sterling hosted.
Right.
Have you adopted any of that style of TV, you know, as far as Night Gallery goes, to fit into your Space Command episodes or anything else you're working on as far as projects are concerned?
Very interesting question.
And may I? One more thing.
Well, please.
How do you select the music for your series?
I'll answer that second question first. There's a talented composer named David Raiklin, who's our composer on Space Command. If you see the trailer, that's his music on the trailer. So he's composing for Space Command and doing a great job. But in terms of Night Gallery, of course, was a series that Rod did after Twilight Zone. It was much more horror-oriented. He was not really happy with the show. He and the producer did not get along well, Jack Laird. But there were a few great episodes, like They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar that Rod wrote, that's just terrific. But horror has its place. And I wrote a book recently with Guillermo del Toro, and Guillermo actually prefers Night Gallery to Twilight Zone because of his bent toward horror. Years ago, I story-edited a show called Friday the 13th series, and it was a lot of fun writing horror. In Space Command, there are certain, mainly it's a positive view of the future, but there are some creatures called the Harvesters who are very kind of horrific, and what they do is horrific, so we do go there, but that's only a part of our Space Command universe, and it doesn't overwhelm it or dominate it.
Great things in Hollywood.
Yes.
I tell you what, did you have a, when the first Space Command was finished, did you have a casting party and everybody was excited with it?
Well, we're going to have a wrap party for the second one in the next few weeks, George, and it's very fun having... Well, you know, I tend to be very loyal to the people I work with, and I love having the actors come back. I love having my crew come back, and so we're really a happy little family. It was very funny because this last 6 days of shooting the second Space Command film, I was very gratified that everyone was very hopeful and excited and thrilled to start, and then by the end of it, they were still very enthused, and they were thanking me for the honor of being part of it. So to keep that kind of team spirit speaks to what we're doing, and we must be doing something right.
Matthew in Alabama, first-time caller. Hello, Matthew. You're up with us.
Hey, George.
Hey, good to have you with us, Matt.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, Mark. You know, you talking about these classic Twilight Zone episodes.
Yes.
You mentioned Billy Mumy, that y'all were friends, right?
Yes, you bet.
Alright. Did you know that Billy Mumy is in one of those classic Twilight Zone episodes called The Monster?
Yes. Well, he's in three great Twilight Zone episodes, and there's the one, It's a Good Life, where he plays this little boy with very, very terrifying powers.
That's the classic. That's
great
the classic.
Episode.
Yeah.
It's a great episode. He talks about wishing people to the cornfield, and so I have to be very careful with him and not have him wish me to the cornfield. But it's so fun writing for him. You know, he's in the first Space Command film, and to be on the set with him and have him, speaking the words that I wrote is just a thrill, and he's such a professional. I mean, he's been in film and television since he was a little kid, so he's so backwards and forwards a professional. He told me a very funny story when he was rehearsing, when he was a little kid rehearsing the Twilight Zone episodes. His mother would read the script aloud to him, and that's how he would memorize it. But he wouldn't just memorize his lines, he would memorize everyone's lines. So at one point they were doing a little rehearsal around a table, and Cloris Leachman forgot her lines, and he corrected her. He was like 6 years old, but he was correcting Cloris.
Well, he was like a boy genius.
Yes, and she was not that pleased to have a little kid correct her about her lines.
He every time he's on our program, Mark, he is just so delightful, and he's fun to be with. And, you know, he talks about Lost in Space. And I had read that it may be coming back in rerun forms and repackaged.
That'd be great. That'd be great. And it really holds up. And he was really just, I mean, he was just unique as a child actor. He was so smart and so charming, and he's still very, very youthful. He still has that boyish quality even now, and it's just, he's endless fun, but always a professional. I mean, it's just, I can't praise him highly enough.
And a musician, too.
Yes, very talented.
Carla's in Milwaukee. Welcome to the show, Carla. Go ahead. You're on with Mark.
Hi. Thanks, guys, for taking me on.
Sure.
My comment is a story. I had the opportunity to meet and know and have a friendship with Rod Serling. Story is, when I was in college at the University of Kansas, next to Missouri, had an opportunity to bring him in for a Festival of the Arts event. Well, being young and naive, I said, well, we'll just pick up in a car. So I picked my friend Eric, the musician, so we picked him up at the airport in Kansas City in a real beat-up old car.
He's probably expecting a limo, right?
Well, of course, and this goes to the integrity and the brilliance of the man. Of course, like you guys, was just a complete fan of him all my entire life, so I really knew the stories and him very, very well, so I was very excited. But sure enough, we go to the airport, and there he is, just standing there with a suitcase, and we pick him up, say, hello, Mr. Serling. We grab him, and we put him in the car, and here's what happened. We're driving. It was a cold, snowy night. We're driving west from Kansas City, and we were so intrigued with him mostly asking us questions. He was fascinating with us and our lives and who we were, and he was an incredible listener.
Well, he probably thought he was being kidnapped, Carla, and wanted to make sure.
No, I don't think so. I think he trusted us. But then again, we were so excited that we was right past the exit for Lawrence, Kansas, and we couldn't get off again for another 80 miles just to peek at him. So, oh, my gosh, he was the keynote speaker with 2,000 people coming.
Oh.
We said, this is not good. So all of a sudden, Rod Serling was just another person. Three of us said, well, what are we going to do? We decided, made the executive decision to cross over the median. So why not? So we tried that, turn left, and sure enough, the car sunk into the mud.
Uh-huh.
And there we were, the three of us.
I love
pushed
it.
The car. There was Eric and me, and Rod said, okay, Rod, could you push? Yeah, okay, one more time. Yeah, rev it up. And we were going, and I always think of those other, he was pretty famous then. It was about 1973. And I can't imagine the other motorists looking at, saying, isn't that Rod Serling pushing the car?
Stuck in the mud.
Well, we did. Needless to say, we got the car out. He got him there just in time. He said, who's speaking tomorrow? And I said, well, it was Laura Nero. We said, how's she getting home? And he said, a limo. He said, I think I'll go with the limo next time. And that's where he went. But we stayed friends ever since until his end. And
yeah.
I happened to be a writer, and he was very nice to me then and ever since, despite that little hiccup. But anyway,
that's a great story.
That's my
Carla.
Little Rod Serling story.
I love it. It's magic all the way. William's in Salt Lake City. Welcome to the show. Hi, William.
Hi, George. I've been listening to you for eight. Well, I started with Art Bell, and beyond that, I'm I'm an old man now, and always enjoyed you.
Well, thank you.
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
I've got to tell you, you know, you're associated with such a wonderful product. I did two Twilight Zones as an actor back, one of them in 63, I think it was.
Sure.
I played a doctor on a 90 Years Without Slumbering.
Sure, of course. Of course, with Ed Wynn.
Right, and I've got a cute little story between me and Wynn. I'll make it short.
Sure.
A lot of other people would like to get on the show, but I remember we rehearsed it once. We had the scene in which, you know, his son-in-law brought him in because they thought he was going nutty. He believed he would die when the clock stopped ticking, or, if you remember. I got a call from the assistant director who said, could you go in, Mr. Wynn would like to talk to you for a moment. And so I said, oh, certainly. You know, it was a real kick.
Yeah.
Here was this incredible old-time vaudevillian and now suddenly a famous actor. And so I went into his dressing room and, you know how you had this funny way of talking. Thank you for coming in. I said, no, that's all right. And he said, would you run the scene with me once? I said, sure, I'd love to. You know, the more rehearsal, the better we felt. So I ran the scene with him. And he looked at me and he said, the most terrible thing any actor can hear. You know, he said, are you going to play the scene that way?
That was his way of telling you, don't do that. Right?
You know, that's right. He's going to destroy what I worked on at home.
In the other one, you were in the parallel, weren't you?
The parallel as well, right.
Well, that's...
So I said, well, yes, would you like me to do it any different way? And he beckoned me to come a little closer to him. And so I walked closer to him and he said, I don't want anybody to know, Mr. Sergeant, but I'm losing my hearing.
Huh.
Could you be louder when you sit across the desk
wow.
from me?
Huh.
So I can hear the cues. My heart just melted. I mean, this was such a moving moment between two actors, an aging actor and a young poet.
That was great. And well, let me ask you, in the seconds I have left, did you further your career after Twilight Zone? Did you do other things?
Oh, well, if you check IMDb, you know, I did about 40, 50 different...
What's your last name?
Sergeant.
Okay.
William Sargent. S-A-R-G-E-N-T.
Of course.
My primary interest was always theater. You know, I was trained in New York. And
we're going to do that. Hey, we got to hit the break, William. We have to... Mark, that's fantastic. We'll be back. Welcome back. Our final segment with Mark Zucre. Mark, William Sargent is indeed that William Sargent. That's amazing. Yeah. I want to read his bio. You ready for this?
Sure.
His real name was Wolf Jacobitz. He was born in Berlin, Germany in 1930. His family escaped Berlin in 1933. They settled in Palestine, where he grew up there before it became Israel. In 1947, the family migrated to the United States, shortened their name to Jacobs, and became naturalized citizens. Wolf, who became William Jacobs, was drafted in 1951. It was a year after I was born, by the way, became a citizen and sent to the Korean front for all of 1952. Upon his discharge, he studied drama at the neighborhood playhouse from 53 to 55 on the GI Bill. After graduation, he was much involved in off-Broadway theater and subsequently signed by theatrical agents who had him change his name to William Sargent, which he later legalized. In 1960, he came to Hollywood for a minor film. Stayed there for 27 years, working in TV and theater. In 1987, he and his wife moved to Salt Lake City, opened up a downtown theater for a while, and he's got a couple cats. But, I mean, you look at his bio, and it is amazing the work he's been on. He's been in Alfred Hitchcock. He was in The Twilight Zone. I bet if we go back and look at those shows, we'd recognize him.
Yes. Well, one thing wonderful about TV back then was, you know, 1 week someone would be on Twilight Zone, the next week on Gunsmoke, the next week on Mannix, you know, or whatever. And it was just great because you had this sort of family that you'd feel that you knew watching them on all these different shows. And they'd just hop from one to another to another to another. So it was terrific to hear from William Sargent and hear that great story.
Well, he's still on the line. I just want to thank him for his work. William, you still with us?
Yes, I didn't know that.
I'm glad you're there. I read your bio. I hope it was okay to do that. Then.
Oh, sure, of course.
And it's great.
By the way, there's one thing. I really was drafted before I became a citizen. You know, when you first come into the States in those days, you know, it took forever to even get a visa. But once you got here and you applied for your citizenship, you were, you know, you were subject to taxation and draft, and the draft was on, and next thing I knew, I was up in the punch bowl in Heartbreak Ridge. I wasn't a citizen until I came back.
Well, thank you for serving, and thank you for listening to this program.
Oh,
and,
it was a pleasure, and I can't tell you, to this day, I get fan mail, and it's always Star Trek and Twilight Zone.
I love it. Thank you, William. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you both, and it's great listening to you.
Thank you.
What a delight.
Yes,
what a
wonderful
delight.
Wonderful. And it's great to hear from those guys. They've got such great memories, and it enriches watching those episodes. You'll always remember that story, watching that episode with Edwin.
I was at a hotel when I was back in Los Angeles several months ago, and Aaron Paul, who played Jesse in Breaking Bad, was there. And he went right by me, and you know, the first thing I thought of was, "Hey, Jesse, hi." And he waved at me, and he kept going, but I guess Hollywood back in the days when William was there, it was a different kind of Hollywood, though, Mark, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and it was very much the end of sort of the golden age of film. You know, so back then in the 1950s, you'd still have Cecil B. DeMille, you'd still have Billy Wilder, a lot of the great directors. Hitchcock was still around, Orson Welles, of course, and a lot of these guys were the first generation of great filmmakers. They were, you know, John Ford, those kind of guys. They were making it up as they went along. There wasn't a huge tradition as we have now. Now we can look at decades and decades and decades of film and television to learn from, to study. A lot of these guys who were the first generation, they were coming from other traditions and finding the way to make film and television speak to the masses. You know, when television first came along in the late 40s, the idea was to do a Broadway stage for the entire country. That's what Rod Serling wanted to be, the Arthur Miller of television, and the audiences were enormous. Nowadays, a big audience for a TV show might be 4 million people, 6 million people.
Yeah.
Back then, Twilight Zone, which was not a huge rating hit, it was getting over 40 million people every single week.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's because everything is so spread out now.
Yeah.
It really is. And then in those days too, they didn't have computer graphics like we have today.
No.
I mean, your spaceships look phenomenal in Space Command. In those days, you could see the string holding up the spaceship model, right?
Yes. But you know, they're starting to go back to some of the old school styles. For instance, there were what are called practical effects, and J.J. Abrams, in the new Star Wars movie, he built a full-size Millennium Falcon. He built full-size X-Wings, and there's a solidity to those things. A friend of mine, Greg Jean, built the city in Blade Runner. He built the mothership in Close Encounters, and he's given us some of these things for Space Command. So he redressed a shuttlecraft from the original Star Trek and The Next Generation for us to use in Space Command. There is an alien ship called V'ger in Star Trek The Motion Picture that Greg built, and he's given us pieces of that we've redressed for Space Command, and warheads from War Games that we just used in the shoot last week. So I love the physicality of real objects, and we're integrating some of those into what we're doing also with CG.
I talked to a guy who builds UFO models, and he illustrates them. He's doing a book, and I told him, when the book's done, we'll put it on our website and maybe even get you on the show. Just very creative guy, and he's just so excited about it. But it's amazing what the mind can let you do.
Yes, it is.
Mark in Canton, Ohio, welcome to the program. Mark, go ahead.
Oh, hi, George. I'm 60. I'm you know, familiar with all the Twilight Zone, and a couple of years ago, decided to start writing science fiction stories, and I'm wondering, am I not you know, am I channeling Rod Stewart? Because, not Rod Stewart, Rod Stein.
Rod Surly.
Because, you know, I too, unfortunately, am a chain smoker, and I thought, I'm like, where are these, I've got over 50 stories, like, where are they coming from?
Are you the reincarnated Rod Surly?
No, because I'm 60. You know, I remember watching him as a kid.
Yeah, all right.
I read them to my friends on the phone, and they love the stories. Unfortunately, I don't do internet or anything, so mm-hmm. I'm afraid I'm going to die with a stack of stories, but it's like, wow. And sometime I'd love to tell you about a UFO I saw a couple months ago, because it's unlike anything I've ever
heard. Yeah, call in again when we're on topic with that.
Yeah, sure. But, I just wondered if there'd be any way I could send a couple to your guest, you know, and see what he would think. Because
Mark, do you take mail?
Sure, yeah. And, it's...
Give out your website, even though it's on there.
I have a computer, but okay.
Sure, but you can find somebody.
Yeah, my website is markzikri.com, and definitely you can contact me. And, you know, it's... I can advise.
I'll spell it. MARCZICREE.com.
You bet.
Markzikri.com. Yeah, get those scripts to him. Who knows? You might buy a few, Mark. You never know.
You never know.
Let's go to Las Vegas. Ken, it's your turn.
Yes, hi. I got a couple questions. One, I'd love to know who has the record for the most appearances on the Twilight Zone. My guess would be either Burgess Meredith or Jack Klugman.
Yeah, they're tied. They each starred in four episodes. And,
well, Billy came close then. He had three.
Yeah, exactly. There was an actor named Von Taylor who was a guest star, and he was in a lot of episodes as well. But Jack Klugman and Burgess Meredith both starred in four, and they were terrific in all of their appearances on Twilight Zone. They were just phenomenal actors. And when I was 22 and interviewing Burgess Meredith, I mean, the thrill of I went to his house in Malibu, in the Malibu Colony, and we sat by the ocean, and he just regaled me with stories about Rod Serling and about being in those Twilight Zone episodes, and it was just a dream come true to meet him in person. And now, of course, with the new Twilight Zone companion ebook, people will be able to hear that entire interview, and I'm so glad to finally be able to share it with people.
And of all the great stars and all the great performances, what would you pick as the most outstanding single performance in an episode?
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Go
ahead, yeah. What I would say is Jack Klugman, he was in an episode called In Praise of Pip, and there's a scene where he talks to God, and usually characters talking to God is really hammy and really not something you want to encourage people to do, but he's so naked and so truthful, and he's sobbing, and he's asking for God to trade his son's life for his own, and he wants his son to live, and he's sacrificing his own life, and he's so raw in that scene and so honest in that scene. It's a phenomenal piece of work, just a great piece of work, and so I love that. Also, there's an actress named Maxine Stewart who, in Eye of the Beholder, when the character's face is unwrapped, it's Donna Douglas, who later played Ellie Mae in the Beverly Hillbillies, but when her face is under bandages, it's a different actress. It's Maxine Stewart, and she gives such a soulful performance, and she throws her heart, everything into it, and she's just terrific, too.
And Burgess Meredith, back to him, was so versatile.
Yes.
I mean, I'll always remember him for his roles in the Rocky movies.
Yes. Well, he was a terrific performer, whether it's Of Mice and Men, where he was brilliant in that, or the Twilight Zone episode, you know, where he's the last man on earth, a bookworm, you know, Time Enough at Last. Or, as you say, the Rocky movies, he's so memorable and so distinctive. He's a terrific actor.
Did he win an Oscar in those movies?
You know, I have to go back and check, George.
I remember him being on stage, giving a speech, accepting an award, and that he gave one of the most heartwarming speeches about the era that Hollywood was being looked at as communists. And he singled out Zero Mostel getting tagged and some people like that. And it was just so heartbreaking to hear him say that.
Yeah,
and then to think back at the paranoia that this country had.
Yeah, well, there's a new film out called Trumbo about Dalton Trumbo, who's one of the blacklist writers, and it stars Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad, and it's a very good film, and it really presents the difficulty of that time and how great it was to finally emerge from that time and have these people remembered for the courage they had during those dark days.
Man, you would think anything outside of the box, they'd label you in those days.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Gene in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Gene, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I always love to hear Mark on Coast to Coast. It's just great.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to mention what my favorite episode, Twilight Zone episode from the original series is, and get your
sure.
I like it and get your maybe some insights
sure.
from you about it. I believe it's the last episode that was originally aired. I think it's called The Bewitching Pool.
Yes, Earl Hamner. Yeah, he wrote that. Yeah, it's an episode. It's funny going back and writing the new edition of the Twilight Zone Companion. I'm able to revise some of my opinions because when I first wrote the book, I was rather critical of that episode because they had some sound recording problems. And Mary Badham, who starred in To Kill a Mockingbird, she played Scout in that film. She's in this, but her voice is looped by June Foray, who was the voice of Rocky the Flying Squirrel throughout most of this episode. And so I was very critical of it. But someone wrote me after the book came out, and they told me that the episode had meant a huge amount to them because when they were a kid, their parents got divorced and no one on television was divorced. It was never discussed. And in that episode, it's about two children whose parents are divorcing and they dive into their swimming pool to avoid the darkness of that experience. They come up in this sort of backwoods paradise with a sort of grandmotherly figure. And he said to watch that episode when he was a kid and see someone else who's going through a similar experience, it made him feel less alone. And when I got that letter, I thought, well, he's absolutely right. And so in the new edition, I referenced that story, and I talk about how that episode does have something to offer people, something of value.
The Living Doll, Talkie Tina.
Yes, a great episode. Telly Savalas and June Foray did the voice of Talkie Tina as well. She was very versatile. And now, of course, they're making Talkie Tina dolls that you can buy. And
I have one.
I
gave one to my little granddaughter who thought of it as a doll, and then all of a sudden she realized she didn't like it.
Yes.
And she would turn it around. She had it like on a little mantle.
Yes.
She would every night she went to bed, she'd turn it around so the head would face the other way or the face would face
yes.
the other way. And every morning it was looking at her. She,
oh, God.
She freaked out. Nobody knows what happened.
It's a wonderful episode. And one thing that was great when I was writing The Twilight Zone Companion is that I found out that Charles Beaumont, who's credited as the writer of that episode, it was actually ghostwritten by a friend of his named Jerry Sowell. Beaumont was starting to experience the symptoms of presenile dementia that would ultimately kill him at age 38. And so he had his friends ghostwriting his Twilight Zone episodes for the final season or so of Twilight Zone. And it was really, I felt very honored to be able to reveal the true authorship of that episode. And Jerry Sowell wrote a great script, and I was able to finally give him the credit he deserved.
The years for The Twilight Zone, they were...
It ran 1959 to 1964. There were 156 episodes, and Rod Serling wrote 92 of them himself.
I was 9 to 14, and I probably saw everyone.
Wow. Well, that's a great way to grow up, George.
But in those days, you watched television, it was a family affair.
Yes.
I remember my dad on the couch. I was always on the floor with a pillow under my head. My mom was there doing her thing. It was a different era in those days.
Well, also something that I think some of the younger people don't realize is that when you and I grew up watching television, you watched it when it aired. There was no way to record it. I mean, I was recording Star Trek on reel-to-reel audio tape just in case they never aired them again. But if you wanted to watch a show, you watched it when it aired. It was not like something you could keep and play
That's
over
right.
and over again.
And then they had kinescopes
yes.
where they were taking pictures of the TV, right?
Of the live shows, the live broadcasts,
yeah.
yes. And those were, they would just aim a camera and film that, and that's how we have some of those live broadcasts where we can watch now. But it was a very grainy process and not ideal.
Henry in Seattle, Washington, welcome to the show, Henry.
Yes, are you there?
Yeah, we sure are.
Yep.
Well, I'm so glad to get through. My girlfriend told me Mark Zickrey's on Coast to Coast, and here I am. I have a great question that I think gets to the heart of the quality of The Twilight Zone.
Sure.
Mark, it's such a pleasure to get a chance to chat a little tiny bit with you. I have interviewed William F. Nolan and George Clayton Johnson on my own podcast, Comics Grinder.
Yeah.
And I'd like to interview you at some point.
Of course.
My
Good.
Question
Beautiful.
To you is, and this is fresh on my mind, you had spoken to the fact that Ray Bradbury helping Rod Serling get up to speed on
yes.
fantasy and science fiction gave him four books, one on Collier, one by Matheson, one by Beaumont, one by Ray Bradbury. I can guess at what titles might have been the titles that he gave Rod. Can you speak to the literary quality of the Twilight Zone? Because I think that is
yes.
really the magic. That quality, we just don't see it enough in today's television.
I agree, Henry. I think that Rod, the thing that really made Twilight Zone shine was that Rod's Rod really valued the writing, and everything else in Twilight Zone served the writing. It was very interesting because Beaumont at that point was already writing westerns for TV.
It was all about the writing.
That's right. And when Charles Beaumont wrote his first script for Twilight Zone, Rod Serling said to him, write exactly what you want to write, and we will air it the way you write it. And Beaumont didn't believe him, but he said, I'll just take a chance anyway. And he was stunned when they aired the first draft of the script.
The way he wrote it.
Yes. And many of these scripts were the first draft. Matheson scripts, Beaumont, George Clayton Johnson, Kick the Can, which George wrote, is a terrific script.
Love that.
And in fact, when Rod won his second Emmy for Twilight Zone, he held it up on camera, and he mentioned Beaumont and George Clayton Johnson and Richard Matheson by name, and he said, come over to my house, guys, and we'll carve it up like a turkey. And and so he really honored the writers, and even in the coming attraction spots, he always talks about the other writers and their scripts, and he's so thrilled to be making these terrific episodes by other people as well as himself.
That's great. And Henry, how do people hear your podcast? How do they find you?
Just go to comicsgrinder.com.
You got it. Okay, good luck with you, Henry. That's neat. I just like all these entrepreneurs that are happening. Like yourself, Mark, as well. You're making a name for yourself. Who knows? You might win an Oscar one day with Space Command.
I know. It's really fun. It's fun to win awards, but the main thing is to do the work. That's what thrills me.
You got it.
And when I hear from the audience, it's just very gratifying.
Mark, be well. Let's get together when I get back to L.A. after Christmas, okay?
Nice day, George. Glad to do it.
Okay, Mark Zachary, amazing. Up next, we celebrate the 100th upcoming birthday of the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra. Robert Davi, who sings Sinatra, joins us, and of course, quite an accomplished actor in his own right. He's next.